Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Last weekend, I moderated a conversation with Gar Alperovitz, Dr. Lester Spence, and John Duda at the Radical Book Pavilion at the Baltimore Book Festival. We spoke about Alperovitz's book, What Then Must We Do?, and asked difficult questions about the economy, corporate capitalism, and alternatives for the 21st century. So welcome. Good to have you all with us here today. We have an interesting conversation coming up. Gar Alperovitz is with us to talk about his books and about his idea about where society is going and why. If we can figure out, I need one more leg, then I can figure out all the stuff. Here we go. American Beyond Capitalism, and the new book is What Then Must We Do? And so we're going to begin with Gar and our other panelists, Dr. Lester Spence, Professor of Political Science, Johns Hopkins University, and John Duda, who helped put together all this together, part of our NMS Collective, who is going to take the public policy end. And we'll have this conversation between us and with all of you to get up there and ask questions and have your thoughts be heard. But we will start with letting Gar kind of outline his book and then jump into it. Gar?
Thanks. First, great to see you all here for this kind of a day, even on a sunny day to come in here. It's fantastic to come talk about a book like this. Let me tell you where the book starts with. I came out of Wisconsin liberalism. I used to work for House and Senate staff, a guy named Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. I was his legislative director. And in part, that era was defined by the capacity of liberals in general to pass significant legislation, both on the environment, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, EPA was established, but also Medicare, Medicaid, anti-poverty programs. And it was a significant possibility to do what in Europe is called social democracy and here liberalism. That era, in my view, is over fundamentally for institutional reasons, above all. And there's lots of things we could talk about, globalization, et cetera. But the most important single change is the radical decline in a powerful institution in American society called the American Labor Union. That was the muscle that informed that strategy. That was the muscle that made it possible for liberals to keep the ball at least in balance for a while. Now, it's a much more complicated story than that, but the starting point of this argument is that that whole system of politics, the corporations get to own the productive wealth, and we get to countervail them, as John Kenneth Galbraith said, is a decline system. And the real question is there another way, even over a long time, to build up a progressive system that would achieve changes in the declining trends of income, wealth, environment, civil liberties, et cetera, et cetera? And virtually all of them are going south. Climate change gases have gone 30% up in the last 70 years. Income distribution has gone, the data is getting worse and worse every day, and you have to keep up with the news to keep up with the declining data. The number that I like to point to is the top 400 people in the United States, you could get them in this tent, have more wealth than the bottom 180 million people taken together. And I often say that's a medieval structure of ownership, because power goes with that wealth. But a medieval historian came up to me and said, no, it was never that concentrated in medieval times. And I think that's true. So one of the ways of saying that is the book argues, and I think we face what's called a systemic crisis, not a political crisis. The trends were going south long before the right-wing Republicans took over the House, and their 30-year trends are not just about who got elected this year, because you've got Democrats and Republicans going in and out. That doesn't mean there's not differences, but powerful long trends that don't change tell you you're talking about something far deeper at the core of American capitalism. And if the old system, countervailing liberal social democratic power, is over, there either is a new system that can achieve the values that many people in this room would embrace, or those trends continue. And that's the second argument of the book. What is interesting about our time, and I think it's very unique and maybe even more advanced than in Europe, is that where the pain is hurting most, what we're beginning to see is changes in the ownership of wealth in a collective or democratic form that is deeply American and begins at the grassroots level itself. So let me give you some examples of if the name of the game in changing the system, even over time, requires changing and democratizing who owns wealth, and if partly the reaction to the pain is that people are experimenting, What does it look like, and what might it point to if we start building a politics in that direction? So the book is really deeply empirical, reporting on stuff the newspapers don't report on and don't have the staff to report on and don't have the interest to report on. So the most obvious form of democratic ownership of wealth is the traditional co-op. What people don't realize is there are 130 million Americans already involved in co-ops. That's a 40% of the population to build on and begin transforming. One element of that is the credit unions. Credit unions are a boring institution, but they have more capital than any one of the big banks in New York. They're huge. And in many parts of the country, people are taking over the credit unions. You can go to the board meetings, nobody ever goes, and you can elect your friends, and people are doing that and begin using that incredible banking source for other purposes. There are 10 million people involved in worker-owned companies, which the press doesn't tell you about. And they are expanding. Worker-owned companies are a very hot subject in many parts of the country, and the press isn't reporting on it. There are land trusts. A land trust is a neighborhood or city ownership of land by a democratic form. 30 years ago, that was anathema. Nobody would do that. Now they're happening all over the country as a way to prevent gentrification on the one hand, or to capture profits and resubsidize local housing development on the other. So land trust, which is a collectivization of land ownership, it's very conventional. There are hundreds of them around the country, and 30 years ago, there were none. So the book reports on this kind of thing. Social enterprise is another part where businesses are set up only to make money for social purposes, or the B Corp, private companies that are set up with legally so they can divert profits for social purposes. What's happening at the grassroots level is there's an explosion of this kind of preliminary developmental stuff, largely, and this is the argument, because the pain is increasing and the old liberal ways don't work anymore. I would take a lot of the liberal programs if we could get them, but you can't get them is the argument, and so you're getting development out of the pain levels that people are experimenting with. The book reports on it, but we have a website, community-wealth, put the dash in, which accumulates material on this all over the country. So that's one level of development, and if you stand back from it as a historian, the argument is over time, this is teaching people a different principle as well as building power bases over time, like the prehistory of the New Deal, when what happened at the grassroots level became the state laboratories of democracy, it was called, became the idea system that later enlarged and became part of national politics, taking the same principles and moving them up. There are other things going on at different levels. State banks are now very hot. Bank of North Dakota is a socialized bank. It's been there 100 years, just under 100 years. There are 20 states considering legislation for state banking. State healthcare systems, Medicare for All or single payer, which is essentially a publicly owned insurance company. That's what Medicare is. It's a nationalized insurance company. Several states, and I think we're going to see a lot of this as the pain and the cost level goes on. Vermont is first. It was passed in California twice, single payer. It was vetoed, and we're going to come back to that as the pain level goes on. And as health care goes down, it's another form of changing ownership. Think about it. That's 20% of the economy. And if you move to the other level, and these are all parts of the argument, there are things happening at other levels of the economy that also are very interesting. Every expert that I know about, left, right, and center, predicts another banking crisis. And the reason is you can't regulate these guys. And so the common nostrum now is, well, we'll break them up. And the conservative economists understood that long ago. If you break them up, they will regroup. The big fish will eat the little fish like AT&T and Standard Oil, and we'll be back at this. I think that leads over time, if you think about a longer dynamic, there's only one option left, and that's to turn some of them into public utilities. That is, nationalize them the way we did with AIG, which we still own, as the government still owns. So I think down the line we're going to see far more interesting things at the national level than most people expect. And I'm sketching very quickly because I want to have time for a real discussion here. Even further arguments of what's happening at the national level I don't think people have caught on to, but the idea that you can nationalize large corporations, which seemed like a crazy idea only a few years ago. Did you notice we nationalized General Motors, we nationalized Chrysler, we nationalized AIG, which is the largest insurance company in the world. We still own that one as a government. And I suspect if the crisis deepens and if more and more experimentation teaches people different ideas at the level of ordinary politics, we may see these principles that seem way off the far edge begin to become very serious in American politics, largely because everything else is not possible, because the pain grows and because the disillusionment grows. So I see this, and the argument of the book is historical. If you look back at how historical development occurs, what these local things that are going on these experiments can be very important if the times and the context permit them. So it gives you a sense of what can be done. A longer way of saying this is that we may very well be in the prehistory. Think about the period before the New Deal, but even more dramatically, the prehistory of building the elements, the fragments at the local level, the state level, the national level, that begin to suggest the outlines of what amounts to a different system of democratizing ownership in different levels all the way up. And that direction is the direction of real great interest that people haven't quite seen because the press doesn't report on most of what's going on and people don't know about it. But if you probe deeply, you'll see it in many, many parts of the country. The punchline of all this, of course, is that at some point when people build a politics around a new direction, that's when things get interesting. So these are the fragments that are elements that are the nitty-gritty that goes into the next program or the politics of it. But when the politics explodes, like the women's movement exploded, like the civil rights movement exploded, like the environmental movement exploded, like what's happening throughout the Middle East, at some point, a politics has to have content, not just throw the guys out. And what I think is happening is that potentially the elements and fragments of the content of a new politics are beginning to be established in this country. And so the pain levels are driving this, but ultimately, you know, I'm a guy who writes books and gives lectures, and I think ideas about all of this don't matter at all most of the time. Power matters. Momentum matters. But when people lose faith in the old ideas, then there's time when ideas about what's possible, what's going on, can become very potent politically. And I think there's a lot of precedence for that. As I say, if you look back at the women's movement in the 1940s, the idea that you could change a whole culture radically was an idea that was not possible in this country, and now it's common sense. And the same thing was true of the civil rights movement for a long time before it became a movement. So the book argues that there is a content building up at every level that suggests the possibilities of a system that is very decentralized, that doesn't look like state socialism, but also doesn't look like corporate capitalism, and that it's very American in its content, very localist, but also of a larger vision, and that we can begin to say there may be a possibility beyond the stagnant old choices we've been told are the only choices, kind of Stalinist socialism or corporate-dominated capitalism. We may be able to build something out of American traditions and out of the pain levels that moves in an entirely new direction. So that's the book.
So let me jump off this way with it. Feel free to applaud. I saw that starting. Hey, please. So whenever Gar writes a book, it's really thought-provoking. I think that in his articles as well. And let me just start the question with our two guests to the right here. What I was thinking about, I don't know how many of you watch Boardwalk Empire, but it's a great series on HBO. There's one line in there with a great actor named Jeffrey Wright who looks over to one of the characters and goes, what shall we do, Mr. White? Then what shall we do? And so I think about the title of your book, which is, what then must we do, America? What then must we do? And that is the question. So let's say these ideas have a lot of validity, for argument's sake, that we're in a major historical moment. There's a shift taking place. Maybe it's a shift, you know, from the progressive movement to where the New Deal happened. Maybe it's a shift even older than that, like between medieval times and industrial capitalism. That could be the shift we're in. But what does that mean? What does it mean about what we do? Theory is good, but what does it mean in practice, do we think? Les, you want to jump off first?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I thank you for your work, Gar. It's really, really important, and I think it does come in a really important time in our historical development. What should we do? So what I'd like the audience to consider, or what I think is really important for the audience to consider about what Gar is saying, is the fact that ideas matter in this moment, and the fact that local politics matters. Now, what does that mean? We have to understand that in this transition to our contemporary condition, we tend to put the blame, those of us with moderate to liberal to left politics, we tend to put the blame on the Republican Party. But you take a state like Maryland, Maryland's been blue. You take a city like Baltimore, the Republican Party hasn't had a significant role in Baltimore politics in a while. If you take something like welfare reform was passed under a Democratic president, the first black president, according to Toni Morrison, said slightly in jest. So what we have to consider is that to the extent we're talking about the local as a side of political engagement, we have to understand that this is not a matter of Democrats, for example, taking power away from the Republicans. Rather, it's a matter of taking ideas, a set of really radical but basic ideas about how the economy is supposed to work, how the public is supposed to work for us as citizens, and then create a set of political platforms by which we either create a separate party or a separate political entity to put those platforms in motion, or we simply put people in place and have their position be incumbent upon them doing what we say. Now, in a city like Baltimore, where you have kind of a strong mayor system, one argument could be that you fight for the mayor. But thinking about local, I would actually argue that city council represents a lever where you start at the city council and then move up. I had a conversation with a city council person just a couple of weeks ago, and I asked that council person, I said, wow, for us to take control of the city council, how many seats would have to turn? And that person didn't want to give any names. I didn't ask for any names. But that person simply said two. If we took two more positions within the city council, then we'd actually be able to begin to articulate a radical response to the way that that the economy in Baltimore is run. So we kind of start by thinking about that. But we have to also, as I'm thinking about it, we have to realize that we can win. That is, we have to start from the premise that it's going to be a long, hard struggle, but it's not a struggle that's predestined that we lose, right? On that note, I think John has got a lot more practical stuff to say.
John, yeah, Duda.
Thanks. And thank you, Gar, and thank you, Mark, and thank you, Lester. I'm here today filling the seat of Jamie Raskin, who, amazing state senator from Maryland, who, a really amazing constitutional scholar as well. So I'm feeling a little honored to be sitting in what was supposed to be his chair, and he sends his regrets for not being able to be here today. Something came up with the state senate that he had to urgently deal with. And I think it's important to remember one of the reasons we had invited Jamie is that there are a lot of policy changes that could be made that are small, that are cheap, that are not terribly controversial, right? There are big fights. Don't get me wrong. There are big fights. What Lester is talking about is a big fight. The arc of history that Gar is describing, that's a big fight. And parts of that are going to be hard, right? There are folks up in the Radical Book Fair Pavilion tent who are starting a campaign modeled after the Vermont campaign to get single-payer health care. We know that's going to be a hard fight, right? Because we can't even get Obamacare, right? We can't even get that thing which was designed by a conservative think tank, right?
And passed
to actually be implemented, right? So there are going to be really, really hard fights that are going to take a lot of organizing, that are going to take multi-year campaigns. There's other stuff that's just waiting there. That's totally low-hanging fruit. All right. So for instance, we want jobs, right? We want to keep jobs in Baltimore, right? How do we do that? How do we do that in a cost-effective way? How do we keep jobs in Maryland? There's a tremendous amount of money that's just thrown away, wasted, because the only strategy on the table is basically bribe corporations, right? It's like, oh, corporations threaten to move. You give them some more money. You give them some more tax subsidies. You tell them you build them a park on the waterfront, right? You do everything that you can possibly do to appease these corporations who then threaten you again the next time they want some more free money. So there's other strategies. For instance, you can invest in worker ownership. And that doesn't mean a tremendous amount of investment. It doesn't mean like financing every single company. What it means is you set up a small center at the state level to help people figure out how to do this, how to transition companies when they're retiring, right? When an owner is retiring, what happens to their company? Do they sell it off to be scrapped by a multinational, or do they sell it to their workers? It's very simple. It's not terribly controversial, and it works, right? There are 10 million worker owners in this country, right, who own the companies that they work at. How did they get there? Well, in part, they got there because some states are already doing this. Ohio does this, for instance. There's a worker ownership center. It's been around for years. Gar can tell you all about it and how it came to be because it comes out of really interesting fights with the steel mills. But that is something that can be easily done. We can set up things like structures that help universities and hospitals spend their money locally. Right? Across the country, there is $1 trillion that is spent every year by nonprofit institutions. And to date, they don't really think about how they're spending it or where they're spending it. But those are public institutions, right? Those are institutions that are supposed to be serving the public good. And if we can tell them, look, you get a great tax break, right? You get, you know, your property doesn't get taxed, right? The city helps you out. The state helps you out with everything you want to do. Why don't you focus your spending locally? Why don't you do that voluntarily? And then that $1 trillion nationwide, the millions and millions of dollars that are spent in Baltimore by hospitals and universities, when that supports businesses and communities, that's going to help things a lot. That's going to help anchor those communities and lift them up economically. And there's tons of things that are like this. They're small tweaks. They're redirecting existing funds. They're redirecting existing patterns of spending. They're not things that we have to think about in terms of, like, you know, year-long campaigns to win a hard victory. They're things we could get tomorrow if we were really mobilized and we were really working to educate the policymakers that are supposed to be representing us.
You've written about workers' co-ops a lot. You've worked in the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland. You can talk about the Cleveland model for a minute and how that fits into this. And as you do, though, one of the things I was thinking about, and I think you even mentioned this in one of the pieces that you wrote, that, okay, for argument's sake, we have workers' co-ops. But if those workers' co-ops, in some ways, are still part of the overarching capitalist system, if they're still polluting so they can get ahead and make money for the people who work there, if they're taking care of their own while everybody else is kind of suffering around them, if race and racism and white supremacy still play a role in all that, in the midst of that, I mean, I think workers' co-ops are a huge step forward, but a lot of issues here beyond just saying this model is the model.
That's a really interesting kind of the way the dialogue's unfolding. Because the last question also says, where does this, what is the theory of this? And I want to urge the theory part, too, because you're asking a question about how do these institutions work in theory. If you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, what do you want, and why would it work? So let me give you a little bit of an illustration by way of answer or an attempt at an answer. I worked with the steelworkers in Ohio in 1977, and the steelworkers in Youngstown, Ohio, the big mill went down, Youngstown Sheet and Tube. They lost 5,000 people in one day. And the steelworkers came up with the notion that this thing is so important to the community and to us, we should set up a community/worker-owned company and take over the mill. So that, for instance, we can then decide if we're going to pollute, we're polluting ourselves. Now, a worker-owned company has an incentive, if it's competing, to cut costs, because it's going to get killed if it doesn't cut costs. And it may pollute the community, that as any company would, otherwise you're going to go down. But a community worker-owned company internalizes that question. It has to decide, what are we going to do as a community? Do we want to take those costs or not? So that was the structure that points in a direction of a different vision. Now, they lost that. They got the Carter administration to finance that. By the way, Bob Embry, a guy here who runs the, which foundation is it? The
Able.
He was
foundation.
An assistant secretary of HUD at the time, and he and I conspired a little bit and put together money to fund this thing. And after the election of 78, it got killed by the corporations. And at that time, this is something about the historical evolution. At that time, the steelworkers nationally were against it. The local guys wanted to do it. The national guys thought, well, I don't want those local guys making trouble. We'll get rid of them, actually. Over 30 years, the state of Ohio learned from that, and there's worker-owned companies everywhere. The steel workers have shifted. They are now promoting this over 30 years. And in Cleveland, there's a really interesting model that's developing, and many other cities are following this. You could do it in Baltimore. There are 10 cities I could go through doing the same, starting up in the same track. It's a community-wide ownership structure, a nonprofit corporation building on the community. This is a neighborhood of 40,000, a very poor neighborhood, 18,000 average income and 40% unemployment. But right in the middle of that neighborhood is Cleveland Clinic, Case Western Reserve, and University Hospitals. They're right there. The term is anchored institutions. They can't go anywhere. They're anchored. They buy $3 billion, with a B, $3 billion in goods and services every year. They're nonprofit corporations. That money, none of it went to that neighborhood. So what's happening there now is this: there's a community corporation and worker-owned companies that are part of it. They can't leave and run off. They're financed by the center. They're trying to build the community, but also worker-owned. And they've got the hospitals and universities to buy from them part of their laundry services, some of their food services, other things, directing more and more of that funding to rebuild the community under a different economic institutional model that democratizes the ownership, not just for workers, but workers and the entire community. So that's a whole new model, and there are 10 other cities now beginning to develop the same model, and it can be done anywhere. You could do it here. If Cleveland Clinic can do it, one of the leading places, there's no reason Johns Hopkins could not get its head around this idea and begin building up community wealth, community ownership, democratizing wealth. So these abstract ideas we're talking about, you can do a lot of things, as John said, right away, and you can do it. But if you build a politics locally, as Les was saying, you can begin to actually make this stuff happen as it's happening around the country. If we had time, I'd kind of take you through city after city. I was just in Atlanta, and they're beginning to experiment with this already, many cities around the country, because it's doable. And what it requires is people to kind of understand what could be done, but also where this could go if we began multiplying it around the country in different ways. One last bit about this. We've been running into so-called local conservatives. The reason I say so-called, they don't look like the guys who are on the radio. They look like retired businessmen who want to help. And they consider themselves conservative, but they say, hey, this is a good idea. Why don't we do this? We're getting really odd things that break down the patterns of what used to be called conservative, liberal, radical. What's really interesting is this is kind of serious work we're building, and they want to do something to help. So there's a way to crack some of the crazy politics in some parts of the country as well if you kind of have a really different model.
You're listening to a panel discussion I moderated with Gar Alperovitz, Dr. Lester Spence, and John Duda at the Radical Book Fair Pavilion at the Baltimore Book Festival last weekend. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. There's more of this discussion when we return in just a few minutes. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Let's jump right back into the panel discussion I moderated with Gar Alperovitz, Dr. Lester Spence, and John Duda at the Radical Book Fair Pavilion at the Baltimore Book Festival last weekend on Alperovitz's book, What Then Must We Do? So very quickly, before we turn to the audience, I'm sure there's some thoughts out in the audience here. I want to get into this conversation in the last half an hour of our conversation. But I'm curious to what we think about how that functions as real change and how that really happens. What that building really means. I mean, you have a city here where, similar to Cleveland, unemployment in the African American community is overwhelming, and so the only way to change that is by jobs. And we're always struggling with what do jobs mean, and can't even get a bill passed to say that people should have a living wage. You know, all that is moving ahead. So, what do you think that means politically? I mean, I what you said about organizing city council, but this is in the past things have moved this ahead. Have been unions. What's moved it ahead has been a civil rights movement that was fueled from the bottom, that created a movement, and that movement fueled more. So what fuels it here?
So what we're talking about is the relationship between ideas, interests, and institutions. And what Gar is actually arguing is kind of that ideas are important, and we've said that. So what does that mean? The transformative capacity of ideas in this moment is that ideas can actually reshape our interests, and then if embedded in institutions can change how we can change how we behave. So when I say ideas can reshape our interests, you think about the issue of race and racism. The reason that that resources are fundamentally or that resources are allocated differently racially within Baltimore and other cities is in part because whites tend to believe that their interests are different from those who are not white, right? And to the extent that there are zero-sum resources at play, they tend to say, well, wow, because my interests are, you know, I'm on the other side than you, I would rather keep those resources for myself and then give them to my kids, right? If we, through ideas, actually reshape what our interests are, we can begin to think of ourselves as having the same interest against, in this case, corporate power, right? And then we can embed those in institutions, and then that leads to change. It doesn't lead to heaven, but real talk, we're not ever going to get there anyway, but it gets there a bit, it gets a bit closer.
That's the best single theoretical explanation of what we're talking about that I've heard. Ideas, and I don't think it matters most of the time, but sometimes ideas can be translated into institutional power, and this may be such a moment, and that is really a really important moment, if so.
Yeah, and this is. I mean, it's an accelerating moment. 9 years ago, I was involved with starting Red Emma's as a workers' cooperative. No one knew what a worker cooperative was, right? We barely knew what it was, right? It's this term that we were kind of pulling out of, you know, the 19th century or something. And things have picked up so much, right? There have been this tremendous upsurge of people interested in these really fundamentally democratic economic institutions. And not just thinking about them or hoping they, you know, arise someday, but actually working to concretely build them. To the point where the Baltimore Development Corporation, right, which, you know, has been for many, many, many years basically saying, like, throw money at the Inner Harbor, throw money at Harbor East, throw millions and millions of dollars of tax breaks at various things. They put out a request for proposals just a couple of months ago, and it said two things, basically. It said, well, we need a consultant. We need that consultant to tell us two things. One, they need to tell us whether any of the things we've been doing actually did anything useful, because we haven't actually been measuring it in any sort of meaningful way. And second, we hear all this noise about worker cooperatives, and all these other cities seem to be getting them, right? So we need somebody to tell us about these, too. Right. So there are alternatives, and as these alternative institutions develop, that helps educate people and it helps get people excited and think that these things are possible. And that's a snowball, and we need to kind of jump on that.
Just a very small point about that, because really interesting. A worker co-op is a business. The American business community has found thousands of ways to get subsidies for business. They are almost all available for the alternative kind of business, too. They are out there for the taking. They are out there for getting your mayor, as they did in Cleveland, on the using all of the programs that already exist to build democratic ownership rather than just standard ownership. So there's a real practical possibilities out there.
So what I'd like to do here, since we're talking about workers' co-ops and building democracy from the bottom up and through, let's talk all of us together. What I'm going to do is, there's only one mic here, so I'm going to hold on to the mic, but I'm going to come to you. I'm still going to hold on to the mic. But I'm going to come to you, all right? Just be clear. Old Phil Donahue ways, I'll hold the mic.
that's an old pro. Huh?
Here we go. All right, so we have about a half an hour together left. Who has questions? Let's start over here in the orange.
Mitch, my man. I like what you're saying, but historically we have some serious problems. Chris Hedges' book, The Death of the Liberal Class, talks about how there's no liberal class anymore that pushes policy. And all these ideas are good ideas, but one of the things with the co-ops, it gives the government and those, and when you say that these people aren't conservatives anymore, they're seeing what's happening in the economy, and in a way, that's a way to save capitalism. It's a smart thing to do. They know what's happening. And these alternatives, in many ways, gives the cover for what really is happening, where the government says, look, you have these alternatives. We're not doing anything to suppress them. And the point I'm getting to is during the Great Depression and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, what happened was there was a real national socialist movement. And these people were saying the conditions are so bad that we are going to challenge this. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, with all his policies, Social Security and all these things, saved capitalism is what he did. So the point I'm making is, I assume, sad to say, and I'm just thought of this, it seems like none of this stuff is going to happen unless the conditions get so bad that everybody says we have to look for an alternative.
And Gar, you that's part of your book. Is it in your book? Why don't you respond?
Well, the first thing to say is nobody can predict the future, and you may possibly be right. We don't know that. But the argument that I think is really important is we live in a time which is, I think, very different from the 30s. Let me give you an example. I don't think we're going to get a major collapse. And the reason, there are several reasons, but one of the most important ones is government in 1929, just before the Depression, was 11% of the economy. It's now 34%, depending on 32, depends on the year. We may get a decay, but there's a big floor underneath the economy. Even conservative corporations start coming in to say, save the system. George Bush's famous line, I'm not going to let this sucker go down, because he would go down with it. So I think we're in a situation of decay and stagnation and stalemate rather than a classical collapse or a Marxist collapse. And in that context, the buildup of alternatives over time may lay the groundwork for something very different. That's the kind of argument. It may be, possibly, it will bolster a progressive capitalism with a whole liberal swing. Or, much more interesting, it may also be, if we're serious, laying groundwork for a very different vision beyond capitalism. My book is called America Beyond Capitalism, that takes us beyond. We don't know the answer to that. But the direction is the same. Build up knowledge and base that gives us... I would not want the kind of socialism that occurred in the Soviet Union. So a different vision of what we're talking about is required. And if it is to make sense and to be democratic, it better start from the bottom up and start looking like these models projected upward. So you possibly may be right. We don't know. But the answer is the same. Let us build power and institutions and ideas that help transform institutions. That's the requirement of the time, no matter what.
Let's go over here. I'm going to go section to section, start in the row, then go to the next one and come back over here.
Thanks, Mark. There's so many things I want to say. But we need new ideas, and I haven't heard any new ideas. I heard maybe some ideas about different structures. Unions did a lot of things for a lot of people. The problem, as I see it with unions, was they became stable, hierarchical institutions. Institutions are a part of the problem, as I see it. I see this still as having a box. I don't want a box. Power is a momentary thing. This is a power situation. We all, I think, need to begin to see power in that way. Power is in obeying. The opposite is true as well. I can't claim that as my own. Humberto Maturana turned me on to that idea. It's a systemic disorder, not a crisis. This is a very important distinction that needs to be explored. But most of all, if I was limited to responses, I'd have to say my final one is to change the structures without changing the interactional dynamics, which I have not seen in co-ops, or very rarely seen in co-ops, is nested in a biology of love, that all people participate, regardless of what they say or how they say it. We need outsiders. We need radicals. Radicals need radicals. But most of the time, I find radicals can't handle radicals. They don't legitimize them. And this is a continuous problem within the anarchist movement. So these are some of my concerns about the panel. Also, I have to say, I'm a little concerned that there's, you know, if we're talking about praxis, which means putting these ideas into doing, why do we have all men on the stage?
I have to ask the organizer of the panel. That's a good question, though. John?
Well, I think institutions are what we make them, right? And there's a lot of institutional change that's possible. You know, I've heard all sorts of stories this weekend about institutions that were moribund and then were animated by new people coming into them, by new ideas. I mean, I think looking at the steelworkers, for instance, right? The steelworkers, yeah, they were a tremendously hierarchical institution that were tremendously fixed and focused on the past, right? They've now opened up. They've now developed a whole idea about how to create co-ops that go beyond traditional co-ops by being embedded within a framework of solidarity with other working people, both expanding circles of economic democracy through cooperatives, but also by keeping people who are in cooperatives remembering that they're part of the working class. That's a powerful idea, and it's a new idea, and it's one that's been developed intentionally through and within the union and is now being deployed in the union across the country, and they've got other unions on board. So it's not just the steel workers, but it's SEIU, it's the United Food and Commercial Workers. It's not the entire union, but it's people within these institutions using institutions as a framework to affect change on a scale that's larger than what you can do as an individual. And that's really, really key. We have to think dialectically about the relationship between institutions and history and our own individual action.
You want to respond?
No, I want to affirm what John said. That is to say, there is a particular form of anarchism, not all forms, that has no interest in institutions. And there are others within that movement who see institutions as necessary, but critically, cultural change and ideational change is required to make them responsive. And I would take that view that we need an institutional shift, but we also need a radical cultural shift and intentionally design both as serious ideas.
And here, I think that the one part of Judy's question was to answer why all men on the panel, which is, I think, is a good question, that when we consciously think about... Judy just said it limits the diversity, and I think it does. Absolutely does.
I'd like to offer something that is hopeful, and it works into the whole movement from the grassroots, and it's not... it's money in politics, but it's also in religion. I'm an ordained Roman Catholic woman priest, and our movement now has over 160 women in Europe, Canada, Latin America, and the U.S., and we're challenging the big boys at the Vatican. We're saying that God is beyond gender, and if you're going to use male-only images of God, we also need to have feminine images of God. We need to have women's presence at the altar in ritual to say women's bodies are sacred, and maybe some of the femicide that's going on in the world would stop, and certainly some of the violence. And we need, in Christianity, the Gospels interpreted from women's living and dying. So what's happening, we've been excommunicated by the Vatican, and just recently, and most unfortunately, Pope Francis has excommunicated a male priest in Australia, in Melbourne, who supports the ordination of women and also equality for gays and lesbians. So what I want to say is that, you know, it is happening. And the people at the grassroots are coming to our liturgies and they're supporting. It wasn't just adding women and stirring, though. It's a renewed priesthood in a reformed church where the people are empowered. Everyone consecrates the Eucharist and gives homilies. So this is happening in other places as well.
Let's go back to the other side, and we'll come back to the middle, okay? Just keep this all even.
The limitation of political power is dependent upon the people who elect officials at all different levels of this government, any government. In particular, I'm someone who has very little faith in the American intelligence. The average American is genuinely stupid, misinformed, or malinformed. And that's why the power gets away with doing what it wants to do. It is only a small number, relatively, a small number of people who are aware, eager to be involved, and can express and articulate ideas that the average stupid American can say, wait a second, maybe there's something to that. It also is a problem of leadership. We do not have effective political leadership in this country. It is afraid of its own shadow, including Obama. And what do we do about fundamental American ignorance?
I'll talk.
That's suspense. Go ahead.
You know, it's fun. We have something. We have an idea in political science. It's kind of there's a way we can actually study kind of ignorance as it relates to interest, right? And thinking about DSU diversity, thinking about racial diversity, there are like around 20 black people in this room. I think that's something that's important. Yeah, Mark, I usually count. I think that there are, we significantly underestimate the capacity of Americans to fully understand their own self-interest, right? So, yes, there are gaps, and there are ideas that people aren't aware exist. There are populations, particularly in the rural areas, that have a woefully misinformed sense of their self-interest. And yes, we have political leaders that are in some cases corrupt or in some cases simply have drank the neoliberal Kool-Aid. But with that said, not only is it one of the most important games in town, in as much as the state still determines a lot of the way that we live, I can't drink clean water without the state. I can't, you know, I can't. There's a there was a pit bull, a stray pit bull in my neighborhood the other day. I needed the state to take care of that. There are a number of ways that we can think of that, a number of ways that the state remains important. But more important than that is that we have to work on the belief that people can change and people can actually understand and change their own sense of who they are and how their identities work. And we have to work with the capacity or work with the assumption that we can actually change the government and make it better. Not just because we have to look forward and say we have to leave something better for our kids, but we have too many instances in the American historical record that says change has happened, right? I mean, Baltimore was the first city to actually segregate, the first city to have to embed segregation in its zoning, in its housing. It was the first one. But look at this, right? Hopkins did not accept women of female undergrads until 1972. We have too many instances of change to rely and promote and reproduce narratives that says we're basically stuck and on the way to hell.
Right here.
So I have a question for you guys. At the book festival, I've been spending a lot of time over in the science fiction tent. And one of the reasons I like science fiction and find it so valuable, like this is not about escapism or mere entertainment, it's because it gives us these vivid visions of the future. And some of them are, of course, quite radical. I'm wondering, I'm a fan of the stuff you guys are talking about, and this might be a failure of my own imagination, but I often have a hard time kind of extrapolating forward from these sort of small, incremental, very practical, very concrete steps to, like, what's it going to be like? You know, what world is it that I actually want to live in? So I'm looking for recommendations. What writers should I read, fiction or nonfiction, who paint that kind of vivid, complete picture, the kind of thing you can kind of say, like, yes, I want to live in that world?
That's a good question. Gar, why don't you start?
Well, I can recommend one book called America Beyond Capitalism.
Who wrote that book?
Yeah. But I think the question is, let me answer it a couple of ways. What's interesting is that the conversation progresses to this issue, even in this room. And it's absolutely right, because what we have been talking about is power and structure and institutions. Then the question is, you know, what's it going to be like? So the other place I'd suggest, I've thought a lot about this, but personally, is if you look at the afterword of the latest book, What Then Must We Do, there's a sketch that I'm really trying to develop. But here, let me give you some ideas about it. This country right now, this is going to sound weird, has no economic problem at all. The economy produces currently $200,000 for every family of four. There is a political problem managing the wealthiest economy in the history of the world, but economically we're already at $200,000 per family of four if it were allocated in a different way, or $100,000 for every family of four and a 20-hour week, out of which you can begin to imagine what could be done culturally in community. So let me give you another way of looking at it. Over the 20th century, technology proceeded and increased income per person in the United States sevenfold. That includes a terrible century, depression, reset, two world wars, massive costs. Even so, seven times, leaving aside inflation. If we do as well in the 21st century as we did in the lousy 20th century, it will be $1 million for every family of four, plus inflation. That's a whole, inflation will be a lot more. Now, look, if you cut that in half, it's $500,000 in a 20-hour week. It's $250,000 in a 10-hour week. It's $125,000 for every family of four. And that possibility, even with resource limits, tell you you could open up an extraordinary society, an extraordinary culture. The possibilities for freedom and liberty and democracy, they're incredible because the technology has achieved this goal, even with resource limits. You can begin to open the idea of a truly democratic vision over time. If you can build it from the ground up, if it is community-based, if it involves every individual in the form of actually getting people themselves to create this, the technology is permissive. Whether or not we can do the politics and the culture, that's our problem.
We have just a little time. There's another event coming in behind us. We're going to have to be out of here. Anybody here on this side I can go to right now?
I want desperately to be optimistic. It's in my every gene in my system. I've always been an optimist. I find it increasingly difficult, even having heard, and I will read your book, along with the book that Mark moderated the other night, McChesney and John Nichols had written, which they end on a positive note.
Dollarocracy.
Yes, Dollarocracy. Do we get paid for that?
No.
No, for mentioning, for mentioning. Anyhow, I think several people have touched on this. I think the culture of greed is a huge factor. I think that our media sidelines people with new, exciting ideas about a change. Our whole economic system doesn't want change. That was one of the things that McChesney and Nichols mentioned the other night. I think when Gar mentions these wonderful movements, the women's movement, we're not there yet. I still do all the cooking and all the cleaning, and I have a very progressive husband who's out there fighting the good causes. The civil rights, 20 blacks, I don't know what percentage of that group, of this group that represents, but we have, 65% in this city alone? So it should be much more than that. What was the third movement you mentioned?
Environmental movement.
Which one?
The environmental movement.
The environmental movement. My God, we're killing ourselves. So I don't know that we're going to have time for these things to happen because they're not even in the incubation period at this point, and our environment is really, truly doing disaster of proportions that most of us don't even know about.
And then there's California.
Right. So we have literally about 8 or 6 or 7 minutes left. So a quick response, Gar, why don't you start?
Quick, and then everyone has a response. So you may be right.
I hope not.
Nothing is possible.
No, why did we have to decide that
everything? Or we bet on the possibility of all the historic movements that have shown things are possible. And you don't know the answer to this.
No.
So you want to play this game, you will never know the answer till afterward. So you get to choose. I'm going to play hard and see what we can do, as other movements have done. Or I'm going to sit here and say, I don't know. I don't think it can be done. I don't know. I'm not saying you're saying that. But that is the existential choice, because no one knows whether you can do this. And you do know that in past people have achieved great change.
Any quick thoughts? I'm literally quick.
I want to take another crack at the brother's comment about ignorance. I think one of the things we have to recognize, we can do it. But there is one struggle we have to recognize that there is a class of people who really are ignorant, or have politics that are very diametrically opposed to the idea of progressive change, and that's you're talking about there your white conservatives in suburbs and in rural communities, and that is to the extent that people in this audience work with folk like that. And talk to folk like that. It's probably people in your families, and maybe actually some of the people in this audience. Part of what we have to do is begin to seed ideas in that community. And to be fair, that's actually, when I say we, that's actually not my thing. That's not something that I can actually do. That actually is going to be tough. But the rest of it, I mean, the reality is people are already doing this stuff. It's not like this stuff has never been done. People are doing it. They're doing it in the state of Maryland. They're doing it in Baltimore. It's just a matter of taking those ideas and running with them.
Let me just say, John, real quick, because we have let the other group come in.
The last thing I will say is that, you know, I think part of the building this idea of building a politics around these new ideas is making sure that when you say you're talking about co-ops, you're talking about land trusts, you're talking about redirecting spending or local economies, that if you're not talking about, say, racial justice as a part of that, then you're not really building a politics. What you're doing is playing around with ideas and models and experiments. And I think it's really, really important for us to make sure, especially in a city like Baltimore, that we have a real movement around this stuff and not just some isolated things kind of, you know, poking at parts of the system.
So I do apologize to everybody who did not get a chance to have a say, but there's another group coming in behind us, so we have to end it. But I want to thank all of our panelists for being here, all of you for being here. It's been a good discussion. That was political economist and author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, Gar Alperovitz. Dr. Leslie Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence and Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and John Duda, a member of Red MS Workers Cooperative. We have to take a very brief break, but please stay with us. When we come back, you'll hear the voices of families intimately affected by police violence in our city. You don't want to miss this. Please don't go away.